Good morning to you all. Thank you for tuning in today. This is the medical edition of the Lowdown. As you may have heard when we started talking about where we were going as things progressed, we knew that we wanted to have one day a week. And you can go back to the beginning of this. This is the day of the week we're reserving to bring you up to date with what's happening in the medical world in our community, at the hospital, at the clinics, from administrators, doctors, and staff who are on the front lines in Kodiak helping us navigate through the pandemic. If you were tuned in last Wednesday, you'll know that we're trying to make Wednesday an Ask the Doctor kind of show. Last week, we got off to a bit of a slow start, but I'm happy to report that for today, we're doing a lot better. I have a handful of questions already from you for our guests today, and they're going to try and tackle as many of them as we can. I think we can, though, get through all of them. But if you have questions, please shoot us an email to lowdown@kmxt.org. A couple of them just came in, new ones. Or call 486-3181, and we'll try and get as many questions answered as we can. Today in the studio, again, Dr. Evan Jones from CANA, Dr. Steve Smith from Providence, Elsa DeHart from Public Health, and for the first time, Dr. Curtis Mortison from the Kodiak Community Health Center. Thank you all for being here this morning. How is life treating us all?
Good.
Good? Things are good?
Yeah.
No cases?
Still no cases. So we're still at a good place right now where we really don't have anything. We haven't discovered any in Kodiak. Hopefully people who might have brought them in hunkered down and they're done with it. But we'll see.
You know, you just in the 5 minutes before we went on the air here, you came up with, there's some really exciting news in terms of testing of capability and the capacity here in Kodiak now. You want to tell me a little bit about what's happened in the last week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, that's the big news that we have for this week is that, you know, a week ago we had no ability to rapidly test people for COVID-19 and, you know, over the past week, both CANA and KCHC and the hospital have all received machines to be able to test rapidly for the disease. And the amount of testing available to us is significantly increased. There's 500 tests on island right now, and that's likely to continue growing. So, and along with that, the state's recommendations for testing have become increasingly liberal, as far as we're able to test more liberally because of our access to that.
So the guidelines have changed a little bit, though, or are they changing in terms of the type of tests you're using now?
Well, we're using, it's a different test. It's a brand new test called, it's made by Abbott. It's called Rapid ID COVID. And it is a molecular test that can be done rapidly. It's very similar to the PCR test that is done by the state already, but the results can be back within 15 minutes on the machine.
So now Providence has this capacity, and the Kodiak Health Center has the community health center has the capacity for rapid tests.
That's correct.
Okay, so you're as of last week, we were all sending everybody to CANA, whoever was recommended from one of the other facilities, and so how much of an increase have we seen in the amount of people who have been tested now?
Well, I think that just looking at it, we're up over, I think we've done three times where we were last week.
Three times.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be surprising to me if this week we go three times of that. Right. Because now we're actually putting it out there that if you have traveled, if you have a cough, even if you have very mild symptoms, before we would be like, well, hunker down and wait it out. Now we're saying, well, come on in, we'll test you. Because the best way to contain this is to figure out where it is. And if we find it, we can contain it a lot easier. So we are testing a lot more people and trying to figure out, has it reached this community? We haven't seen evidence of it yet, but we're going to look.
Now, how trustworthy is the rapid test in comparison to the test that was done before?
I'll speak to that if no one else is going to take it. So I think that it's important to know that the rapid test, you know, it's been pushed through for fairly quickly. So the numbers that they've tested has been lower than with the initial test. However, it does seem to pick up very, very small amounts of virus. So it seems to be very good at picking up virus if it is present in the nasal cavity. As far as I think we're going to learn a lot. We're actually our testing devices came from the state, and so we're actually being required to send a sample also to the state, as well as doing the rapid test is almost a confirmatory test. So I think there's going to be more to come as far as the exact sensitivities and specificities of the test as time moves on.
Good. There was a question concerning the village testing from when Dr. Pletnikoff was in last week and was talking about how the villages were going to be attended to. That's progressed, right?
Yeah, we are receiving tests from the villages, and we are reaching the point where now anyone in the villages who wants to be tested can be tested in their village, and it'll be brought into town and processed. And so we're really reaching out with our capability to find this.
Okay. Now, so the big question then a lot of people's mind is it here and we just don't know about it because we haven't tested the right person? Or is it not here and we're still trying to keep it out?
If I were to do my shooting from the hip guess, I wouldn't be surprised if we've had a case of COVID in Kodiak and they've done the right thing, hunkered down, and frankly, they're better now. Because the vast majority of young people are going to have mild symptoms and be okay. And if they do the right thing and hunker down, they're going to be okay. It just wouldn't surprise me if somebody said, yeah, we've had three cases, you just didn't know about it. But we'll never know for sure unless we start doing antibodies. And that's a whole nother ball of wax. You got to take a blood sample then, and then we're looking for antibodies to the COVID virus. And so it's a slightly different approach to detecting disease. It doesn't necessarily detect active disease, but just seeing that you've been exposed to it.
Is that being done on the mainland? I haven't actually heard about antibody testing as of yet.
I don't think we have a test for antibodies yet. The CDC is working on that process. So currently our disease detection is based upon the testing for the virus itself.
Okay.
So for screening purposes, we don't have an antibody, but there is an antibody test, and they have been checking areas, especially in California, have been checking how much penetrance have they had into the community to figure out how many people have been infected over time. And they're actually doing random checks of people who volunteer, obviously, because you got to give a blood sample. But like Steve's saying, it's not an official test. It hasn't been approved by the CDC, but kind of like our instant detectors, it gives us an idea of what's going on.
And it takes a couple of weeks after somebody's recovered for those antibodies to be high enough to show. They're looking at
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I think there's a lot of research going into that. But I think for where we're at in the pandemic, the viral tests, the tests that actually test for the virus is more useful clinically. Mm-hmm. But I think as we work our way through this and as we see maybe who has immunity to it and things like that, I think the antibody test could be really valuable in the future. We just don't have, I don't think we're quite there yet.
We're under the assumption that there's going to be an immunization by March or April next year. That might not be true. We might not have one. I don't know. And so then we start looking at herd immunity, meaning that we need about 30 to 50% of the population. Some people say as high as 70% of the population to be infected to kind of slow down the disease process in a community.
Well, doesn't that mean a lot more people die then?
Unless we want to, boat up all of our young people and send them to Woody Island and
and lock them up.
That didn't work last time, did it?
No, it does. That is what it means. It's a tough one. People ask me all the time, how long can we hunker down like this? We have zero cases. How long are we going to live our lives like this? It's a tough choice. It's a tough decision of what is best for the population, because people can't live forever without working. And it's a lot to ask of people.
That is a big question here. We got a question that says, as time goes on and there's no positive cases that have been confirmed, what do you say to people who are convinced there is no virus here and that these precautions that we put in place aren't necessary anymore?
So I would tell them that, first off, all these precautions have worked, and we know that this virus is real. Hopefully we won't see it in Kodiak, but like Evan said, we may have already seen the virus here. We just weren't aware of it because people did the right thing. So you still have to follow those guidelines of social isolation and at least trying to protect other people.
Well, and part of our job at Public Health, too, is doing the contact tracing. So someone does get sick, it's our job to then go and try and follow all the places they've been and who they've been in contact with. And boy, it's really nice when you call somebody and they've been nowhere but home, or they've been one place or talked to two people, you know, instead of 30 people that have to be followed and monitored every day. And in quarantine, you may only have one or two. So really that staying home is still really important.
Yeah. And I think that gets to the heart of the value of these rapid tests, is that if you know someone has the disease, then right that day, then you can do that contact tracing. Sorry, that was a mouthful. And you can do it right away before they expose other people. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a huge value in that.
There is. It's really hard to remember back what you did 30 days ago and who you talked to. You know, if it's taking that long for the test to get back and everything, going back how long you might have been shedding the virus. So
yesterday was tough. I'm not sure about 30 days ago. So where did all this new capacity come from? From last week to it was a miracle almost that we got all these rapid tests to now where we seem to have a bounty.
Yeah, I think as the harder hit states are starting to get their equipment caught up, states like Alaska that are a little less hard hit are getting the runoff from Abbott Laboratories and other places producing these. And so it's just a matter of the supply is finally catching up with us, that we're able to get a few.
So are more coming in?
Yeah, we're getting we're guaranteed 80 additional per week, but they've told us that if we need more, we can get more. And so they are sending in the test kits to us on a regular basis. And I don't know how many the hospital and KCHC has been promised, but there's plenty of availability now, where when we first did this radio show, we had the capacity to check probably 80 or 100 people, and we couldn't foresee when we were going to ever get more. And so we were hanging on to them like they were gold.
So at a time in the future, do we see enough available to where we could have a line at Public Health and maybe we could do 1,000 people? Or would there be any value to that?
There's really not a lot of value in testing totally asymptomatic people. It doesn't, unless you have enough viral load for it to show up on the test, even these tests. So, you know, we want people to have, but they can have very mild symptoms now that those guidelines have opened.
So that's why if somebody's got the sniffles now, you say, okay, let's test. Yeah. Where, you know, we don't have to wait for you to have advanced symptoms anymore.
Well, and it's actually kind of shocking. Like, the more and more we're getting to know about the virus is that, you know, there are people that even consider themselves asymptomatic that do have the virus, that do test positive for it. It's the one of the really challenging parts about this particular virus, and why I think it's so effective at spreading, is because you don't need much to be able to have it as far as symptoms, and the variation of symptoms from some people being critically ill to being basically nothing. It's pretty impressive, the spectrum of that, and that makes it very hard. Again, when we were really limited on tests, you know, even as of a week ago, when we were really limited on tests, it's like, well, who do you choose to test? Well, we only chose the really high, the really sick people, versus now we can really liberalize that. And that's going to really help us with being able to track down people with disease, to do the contact tracing if we find the disease. And, you know, hopefully, and I know that one of your things is going to be on the elective procedure type thing and stuff through the state. But, you know, I know that we're planning on the hospital. Any hospitalized patient should get tested just because they're, you know, they're at a high risk for exposing other healthcare workers and other things like that. So there's probably certain situations where an asymptomatic patient would get screened. But in general, that's not what we're trying to do.
Well, and being asymptomatic and testing negative doesn't mean you may not have it in 6 hours, you know, or in 8 hours. So it doesn't mean that you're good forever and not going to have it. I think that's...
And the other possibility to think about is, are we going to screen people who are coming to town? We're about ready to get a huge influx of seasonal workers in. If we haven't had it already, there's a good chance it's going to come in with the summer season, as a lot of fishermen come in and a lot of cannery workers come in, and they're considered, they are essential workers, so they will be coming. How do we approach this? I mean, even then, with the amount of people coming, do we have enough testing capacity to test every single person who steps off the plane? That's a tough one.
But we have the quarantine in place, though. I mean, it's sort of a self, you know, self-monitoring type thing. But if somebody comes in there, aren't they supposed to go hunker down for 14 days?
Yeah. Can still go to the grocery store, can still do other stuff. It's a tough one. I think it's a good thing, but it's not perfect. And I understand why you can't lock people in the jail for 14 days.
Yeah.
It is a kind of a self-monitoring system.
And some places are doing more like when people get off the plane or whatever, doing temperatures on everybody, you know, taking some symptom checks that may not be evident, you know, to see who might need testing or might be having virus.
Well, Dr. Mortensen, you sort of alluded to the learning curve here. What kind of new things have we learned over the course of the last couple of weeks about the virus and how it operates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in regards to symptoms, you know, initially it was really simple. It was fever and then cough or shortness of breath and travel or exposure. Like, that was initially, as of, you know, 3 weeks ago, that's what we were doing. That's basically the only people we suspected for having the virus. And now there's gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And now I've even heard of unusual things like vasculitis being associated with it. And so just and then even to the point of totally asymptomatic people without any known exposure or any travel history, you know, having it. And so it's really evolved as far as, you know, we really kind of were this past week. I know Providence did it and we went to this. We are treating every patient. We have masks on all the time in the clinic. We are treating every patient as if they could have COVID. You know, that doesn't mean we're doing like negative pressure rooms and all that, but we are trying to take precautions for if any patient that came into our clinic, which we're trying to keep to a minimum, by the way, is any patient that comes into our clinic, that we are trying to treat them as if they might have it. So
those of you who hoarded toilet paper out there, you can be justified in saying, now we know there are gastrointestinal symptoms.
Really? Okay, but for the non-medical people in the audience, which may include the host of this show, what's vasculitis and what is that? What kind of a symptom is that?
You opened it.
Yeah, I know. I opened that bag of worms. Vasculitis is inflammation of blood vessels, essentially. And so it can present in different ways depending on where the vasculature is. But it can be like a rash. It could be one form of vasculitis is what we call temporal arteritis, which is usually headaches. So it has variation, a myriad of symptoms you can get from it. But
okay.
Anyways.
That's why we all looked at Curtis, is because there's so many different things associated you got with it. That. You're like, you opened it.
I probably didn't close that door very well. Yeah.
I think the other thing we've been learning is a lot of people have said, well, this is like a bad flu or something. It's much more than that. They still don't know what the viral dose is for this, meaning how much virus does it take to get infected with this? It doesn't take one virus to get infected. It takes a load. And there may be something to do with how much of that initial viral dose you get to how bad your disease is. We were all curious, like 31-year-old healthy doctors dying of this disease. Why did they die and other people didn't? And there's some thought that maybe the initial viral dose that you get, people who are intubating a patient who is very infected and shedding a lot of virus, getting a huge viral dose from being right over that patient, because they get this huge influx of virus that spreads all over their lungs immediately, they have a higher chance of dying. It's all theoretical, but it isn't quite like the flu. They are finding that this hangs on to the receptor in the lungs that it attaches to. It's called an ACE2 receptor. It hangs on to it about 10 times as strong as a typical flu, so probably takes a much lower viral dose to get infected than a typical flu, and it is much more contagious than the typical flu.
Well, this may be a stupid question, but doesn't this multiply once it gets inside you?
Yeah, it does, but the second it hits the body, your body's already trying to figure it out and trying to make antibodies to it so it can fight it. So the more time, if you get a micro dose of this, it's very, very small, your body's already starting to make a defense against it. Where if you get an overwhelming dose of it, it's hard to set up your defenses quickly enough when your whole lung gets infected at once rather than a small patch of it.
So that's why we need to wash our hands. I mean,
every day.
Yeah, no. I mean, if you get some on you, the quicker you wash your hands, right, you get less of a load.
Yeah, once a day, whether you need it or not.
All right, so we got a question with the earlier discussion about, would it be helpful to collect antibody data for vaccines?
For vaccine purposes.
I mean, I think a lot of this is the simple fact, and I, you know, I'm humbled every day. The simple fact is we don't really know. I think the antibody part of this is something that's being researched really vigorously right now. And so I think that I will just say for myself, this is somewhat of a guesswork, but the antibodies could potentially tell you how I would look at it as in the future, if we needed to find out if somebody's been exposed and potentially has immunity to the virus, that's what the antibody test would test for. It could, if we had a vaccine, it could be that somebody that the idea would be is that if we did have a vaccine, we'd give that vaccine and you develop those antibodies. So you could actually test to see if somebody's immune either by getting the actual infection or by the vaccine. You know, it doesn't really matter which way potentially. But we do this for other viruses right now. So if somebody, we have, you know, hepatitis B vaccine. And so if we want to make sure, for example, when we went to medical school, we had to make sure we had our titers, or what was the antibody? Do we have antibodies against hepatitis B? And if we didn't have them, then we had to get our hepatitis B vaccine to make sure that our body was protected against that virus. And I could see this looking very similar in the future. We're just so early in the disease process that we're not sure exactly at this point.
And then I think that some antibody work is being done with as treatment. Some research is being done where they're getting antibodies from people and being able to treat some people who are critically ill and giving them those antibodies to help their body fight the virus.
Yeah, that might have been what the question was about. Maybe I just went off on a tangent.
No, it went vaccine, so you're right.
So I think what Elsa's referring to is they're doing research on collecting plasma from individuals who have had COVID-19 and recovered, and whether that can be used as a therapy for somebody who's severely ill. And that all that research is ongoing. It's nice to know that there are people who are far smarter than me looking into all of this. I'd like to, one thing that I think we have to emphasize is that we have to assume that most people are infected from the EMS and the emergency room standpoint. So when the ambulance is called, the providers there go to a residence or a call prepared for that patient to be COVID-19 infected. So they're wearing full protection, N95 masks. And then when they transfer that care to the emergency room, we treat those individuals as the same, being overly cautious until we can determine otherwise. And some of that will involve the rapid testing, other evaluations. So I want the public to know that from the emergency room and the ambulance standpoint, that we're taking this very seriously, trying to protect not only our own staff, but any patient we see. And I can't emphasize again, going back to the, this is real. Just because we haven't seen it doesn't mean that we're not going to, and we've got to practice a social isolation, wear a mask. I think Evan's comment about what are we going to do with potential influx of people, how are we going to test them, those are all things that we're all, next week we'll have a different answer on that.
So the rapid test actually helps your facility, because if you could actually give somebody something, you can better allocate resources, right? I mean, you can then decide, I don't need to use as much care, as much, you know, protective care in dealing with this person. And if you all three have separate facilities set aside for treating a COVID patient rather than, you know what I mean? I mean, as I understand it, the health center has like afternoon clinics and morning clinics where you're trying to see people and keep them isolated at different times. The hospital has a separate wing,
alternate care site,
and Canna, you have the Mill Bay Center set aside. I mean, this kind of would free you up if we saw an influx of cases, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and so the big thing is, we're anybody with respiratory symptoms, or even, frankly, at this point, having diarrhea, we send it to the Mill Bay Clinic to try to keep people with things like rheumatoid arthritis or things like that separate, so that we don't accidentally infect people. It's our goal, but we're doing what we can with it.
And we've actually, just this past week, have set up the Baptist Mission's been really generous and allowed us to use a building on their campus, kind of across the street from our clinic, where we're doing afternoon clinics there. We've struggled to know what to call it, whether to call it the fever clinic or the drive-through clinic or whatever, but basically we're seeing patients that we feel like aren't sick enough to need to go to the ER, but aren't well enough to just say, okay, why don't we just kind of let you hang out at home. So that kind of middle ground, in fact, I called it the Goldilocks clinic, just right, but there are cases that need to be seen, like a young kiddo that has a fever that, you're worried about an ear infection. You just really can't check that from doing telemedicine. And so we've set up a site. We don't have the two clinics set up, so we've kind of set up this temporary site where we can see those patients.
So
both Evan and Curtis's clinics, they're the front line in this. And then when they determine that somebody maybe needs to be assessed further, then they'll call us, we'll evaluate them in the ER. And based upon that evaluation, we may determine that somebody meets what we call this mild class of patients who can't do it at home. They maybe need a little bit of supplemental oxygen. And now that we can do the rapid test, if we know they're COVID positive, then, and those individuals don't need more intensive care in the hospital, but they need some oxygen kind of monitoring, we'll send those patients over to North Star to that alternate care clinic, and then the providers can monitor them. If they show signs of decompensating, which usually takes place over several hours, it isn't like 10 minutes you're good and then 10 minutes later you're bad. So if that person is showing signs that they're worsening, they'll be transported back to the emergency room by the ambulance. We'll evaluate them and then make a decision about whether we can manage that person here in Kodiak, or need to transfer them up to Anchorage to one of the tertiary care centers. And some of that will be based upon if that individual has decompensated or gotten worse to the point where they may need to be intubated, then right now those patients will be sent to Anchorage to one of the hospitals there. But intubation is kind of the last in this whole process. If we can manage patients with supplemental oxygen that's more concentrated, that's the first step. I know yesterday we had a discussion about fluid management. The management of these patients is almost flipped upside down from the whole sepsis management with somebody with bacterial infections. We gave them large amounts of fluids and were rather aggressive in a different manner than we are with these patients.
Okay. Question about, do we have enough for the people in the medical community? Is there enough protective gear? Do you have enough if you had an influx of cases?
These simple surgical masks, I get one a week. That's it. And so people ask, how effective are they? They're good at keeping me from getting other people sick more than anything. It's the N95s that we have to be most careful with. We actually have a decent supply right now at our clinic, but it's going to disappear quickly if we get a large influx of patients. Right now, I feel like we're okay. I don't know how the KCHE and the hospital are.
So we actually, a few weeks ago, purchased reusable. They're not N95. That's the specific type of mask, but they're a different type of mask that has, it's actually a little bit more protective even than N95s, but they're reusable. And the reason why we bought those is because we saw that it was going to be hard for us to get those N95s, and so we bought those for our providers and staff. So that's what, if we were, right now those are only being used with patients that are really highly suspicious for COVID-19. We're using the surgical masks, like Evan said, for just kind of every day, in the clinic and trying not to infect each other and those type of things. But if we need to go to those, then we basically, as far as the masks go, we should be covered.
And I just heard last night that the state is in line to get, I think, 3 million that they have an order pending that hopefully will come through shortly for a huge number. So that will really help our Alaska.
And currently in the hospital, providers. We have a very adequate supply to protect both our caregivers and the patients.
Yeah, I'm going to ask this before because my phone keeps dying. Are the quarantine instructions mandatory directives, rather are they voluntary?
So my understanding is they are unenforced mandatory. So I don't know what that means.
Yeah, because there are fines associated with them for people breaking them, but I don't know that they are particularly being enforced. I suppose if there were really blatant somebody doing something very rudely, coughing on food or doing something awful, that they would certainly be on top of that. But that'd be a good question for our EOC.
For the EOC. there's questions about, are there plans to start taking temperatures at the airport with this influx of seasonal workers?
Again, I'd have to agree with Elsa. I think that's more of an emergency services council to deal with some of those broader population screening. And
another one, who decides if the processor's safety plans are adequate?
I know that one just because they go through our EOC, but they also go through the state level EOC. I think that they were saying that they had something like 2,000 plans they're going through right now, including all the processors. And then they go through and change what they think needs to be changed, and then they send it back for corrections or updates, suggestions. So that's going through both the local and the state levels of scrutiny.
Here's a kind of an off take on that. If a person who has just returned from traveling has an at-risk family member, is it recommended or even possible for them to get a rapid test? And what would be the out-of-pocket cost for the person to get one of these tests if somebody just wanted one on demand?
I have no idea what the cost is, to be honest. I'm not sure. This is the tough part about modern medical care. It's hard to nail down what the costs are going to be. If they want a test, they just need to call their doctor's office. They can call KCHE or Canada, even if they're not a patient. And we will screen them out. And I think, like Curtis has said, we've become very easygoing about who we test. And we would be happy to test people who are concerned about it, especially people who have higher risk population in their household.
Yeah. I think that you know, the caveat to that, we're talking about how the testing is, you know, rapidly expanding, and that's really great, but we don't have 12,000 tests. And so, you know, as far as screening asymptomatic people, we still have to be a little bit careful on like, you know, we can't just like, you know, go to Safeway and just start screening everybody that comes in the door at this point. But I think, and so in the case that was described there, you know, I think you have some options. One would be to, you know, quarantine yourself from that high risk individual for the amount of time. I think it would have to be a discussion one of our providers would have to have with that patient regarding the pros and cons of getting that test. The other thing is, if somebody's asymptomatic, again, I think that the quality or like the test, like whether how effective it is or how, you know, it was kind of made to test people that were symptomatic in some ways. So probably the accuracy of the test, if in an asymptomatic patient, may not be as good, but we don't know that for sure.
Well, and it makes sense to test somebody, like if they're coming into the hospital for a procedure, to test them there, because you know that they're going to be there X amount of time, you know, and things may change. But if you're testing somebody and say, oh, now you're perfectly good, they may not be. They may just not have had a high enough load to show up. So it's not a total safety net.
So I would tell that individual who had traveled coming back to a household with a high-risk person is they should still practice the social distancing. Even if we do this test, it might be negative now. Like Curtis said, we don't know how sensitive it is. We're concerned about, is it going to miss some of those positive cases? And the other thing is, we don't know enough about this virus to know exactly when somebody becomes symptomatic. I think even mentioned, you know, you have to develop a viral load to become symptomatic. And how quick that happens, and if we test early and they have a very low viral load and we're not picking it up, mm-hmm. And they become symptomatic. So I think if you have a family member who's at risk, you still need to practice the precautions, social distancing, stay in a different room, use a different bathroom, and wash your hands. Maybe more than once a day, like Evan said.
I'm willing to negotiate.
We've talked about flattening the curve. We're talking about making sure we don't overload our healthcare system. Is there any indication that you're getting from outside that either Anchorage or Fairbanks are starting to see more of a load?
I think that, we're seeing more patients tested in the state. I think it was up to 8,300 roughly. And the number of cases is increasing, but definitely those facilities are not overloaded. I'm not getting any indication, and we can actually check that daily on the Providence system, both in Alaska and the down below Providence facilities, that they're ahead of the curve as far as being ready for a surge of patients. So we haven't seen it in Alaska, and hopefully we won't.
And I know that there's others in Anchorage and Fairbanks and other communities. They have a similar setup where they have an alternative care site for kind of the more mildly ill COVID patients, that they have a setup similar to what we have out at North Star. And so that would increase their capacity potentially in the hospital if it comes to that. I know we talked before the show a little bit about the elective procedure thing that was brought up by...
I was going to get there, yeah.
I think that they're talking about opening up. The governor talked last night about opening up some elective procedures. There hasn't been a formal mandate as far as I'm aware of at this point in time. But again, I think that there's the pros and cons of that. The pros are, economic, and perhaps, you know, some patients have been waiting to have procedures that are considered elective that, you know, are important procedures to have done. You know, they're dealing with a painful condition or something like that. So those are the benefits of it. The risks of it is that anytime you do surgery, there's a risk of complications. And so those patients could potentially have a complication to that surgery, end up in the hospital, taking up a valuable hospital bed in a setting where there might be something, you know, if we had this, if COVID really started skyrocketing in our state. And then the other part is just that anytime you bring somebody in the hospital, you know, there's a risk that they could have COVID. They could infect hospital staff members, which, you know, is the other risk of starting to bring in elective procedures. You know, I think that's a really tough decision. There's just so many factors to it. But I think that that's kind of the risk-benefit ratio that needs to be looked at with that.
While we're kind of on this topic, I do want to take this platform to squash a lie that has been spreading around town. Somebody has been saying that KCHE and Canna are testing pregnant moms with the intention of taking away their baby if they test positive. I've had several patients come back to me with this, and I want to adamantly deny that this is true. We would never do anything like this. I've never even asked Curtis about this, but I can guarantee KCHE would not be doing this, and I can say that Canna would never do this. If you hear this as a pregnant mom out there, that is a complete fabrication, and the person who's doing it is doing a complete disservice in the community.
That's really good to know. There's a lot of rumors floating about.
So one of the things that, and certainly even in Curtis, who are doing active OB, but we have been talking about this up on labor and delivery, is if there is a mom who is COVID positive, she will go into a separate room that has negative pressure. That provider and those nurses will be allocated just to that COVID positive patient. And another provider and other nurses will take care of non-infected OB patients. And one of the things that they aren't going to take the baby away on a, but they're gonna have mom wear a mask to keep droplet projection down, and then just for breastfeeding, have mom wash her breast before she nurses her baby and stuff. So there's some recommendations through the CDC and the obstetrical community on that, but other than that, mom wearing a mask, things will kind of proceed as normal.
So if given the option to open things up a little bit and start doing some more procedures, do you think that that would be something that you would start doing, I would imagine economics would drive that whole discussion at each organization, but is the CARES Act going to benefit you in any way? There was supposed to be a large influx of money delivered to the state that was going to help healthcare providers.
Yeah, I can't comment on that. I know when we talk about elective procedures, we're the one that was mentioned earlier was carpal tunnel surgery, which would be elective. It's a convenient surgery when we do that, and that's actually right now we're waiting on the official mandate from the governor, and then Providence Health System is looking at both in Alaska region, you know, how are we going to proceed with that. So that's all being looked at, and tomorrow we'll have a better answer on that. Like Curtis said, you know, these, we have to think about the impact on the patient and potential staff. The other thing is some, maybe not elective procedures, but things that we can't normally get done in Kodiak. And the one that comes to mind is echocardiograms, which is, in layman terms, an ultrasound of your heart. And we need to know that to manage individuals who have cardiac issues, heart failure. The cardiologists are involved in that patient management, but we have to bring somebody in from Anchorage to do that. So it's, you know, do we bring somebody in? We definitely need this test. How do we do that? Do we bring them in? Are we going to test that person? Are we going to test each patient? And we're actually in the process of trying to figure that out, because we stopped that service a month ago when this all started up, and it is a need for a lot of our patients to figure out how to provide that service safely for the community, the patients, and somebody coming down from Anchorage to do that procedure.
What does the World Health Organization have to do with us?
Even?
does not affect me very much on a daily basis. It's a tough one. I think the reason it has gotten into the news a lot is their interview with the health officials in Taiwan, and the whole Taiwan-China issue has gotten them a lot of flack. As far as WHO on a daily basis, it does not affect my care in any way.
Good.
And the CDC works closely with the WHO on health issues around the world, you know, TB, other, all sorts of things. So,
very political.
Yeah. Sometimes people ask those type of questions. This is a question that's come up every week since we started this, the importance of a flu shot.
Yeah,
we still need to get them.
Yes, and luckily, I mean, right now what they're saying is that we're not seeing a lot of flu in, you know, in Alaska, which is great. People have been immunized, or we're getting near the end of our time, but it is nice if people get their flu shots, and they're hopefully not going to have flu plus COVID, which has happened to some people. And it does take a couple weeks to really kick in, but, you know, the Public Health Center has flu vaccine for anybody who wants it. Just give us a call.
One advantage of hunkering down is we have not spread the flu either.
Yes.
But the truth of the matter is, I had a kid up there before this all blew up with two types of coronavirus and influenza all at the same time. It's a coronavirus that is not COVID-19. It's just a cold-causing coronavirus. But they're actually infected with two different types plus the influenza, and you absolutely could be infected with influenza plus COVID-19. And so you don't need to be fighting two things at once. So I do encourage the flu vaccine.
So the flu vaccine changes every year. They make progress on it. It's fairly effective. And there's some indication that this coronavirus is going to mutate in some ways, possibly. So it's one of those kind of out in the left field questions, but if we get a vaccine, is it something that we're going to have to get every year because it's going to keep changing?
I would think so. I think it probably, just like every year, they look at the flu viruses that are going around the world, and then they adjust the vaccine to fit what's showing. So it may be that when we get a coronavirus, it may alter it a little bit depending which strain they're seeing the most of.
So the big thing is, with any immunization, we're looking for commonality. And is the part that's changing on it going to make it so that it's not recognized by the body if you've been immunized? It's tough to say. Right, for a while there, not too long ago, just like a week and a half ago, we're tracking eight different variations of the coronavirus through the world. I just read last night 30 different ones now with one major mutation. What does that mean for vaccinations? If it changes enough where the proteins that are seen by the body have changed, it may not recognize it as the same virus. It can have slight mutations so that we can track where it's traveled through the world, but it doesn't affect the immunization. But it may get major changes. So the body no longer recognizes that. It's going to be, I think we're still trying to track down how quick this is mutating.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, right now is like the time where it's going to mutate probably the most, because it is just traveling. Like, viruses mutate partially when they're being spread, and there's, every time it spreads, it has a potential for mutation. And so just with the rapid spread of the virus right now, you're probably seeing more mutations. Again, this is hand waving, but there's more mutations probably happening now than are going to be in the future. But I think as far as whether or not there's going to need to be a seasonal changing vaccine, my personal guess would be yes, but like, I don't know. I think we're all kind of guessing in that.
Okay, let's close it out with a kind of a concrete question for all of our listeners out there. What should the average day for a Kodiak resident be like?
Wash your hands, stay away from people, 6 feet, wear a mask.
And my encouragement is, I'll continue to encourage getting out and exercising every day. Hunkering down does not mean hiding out in your house and doing nothing. You're going to get depressed, and it's not a good way to live your life. You can't get together with friends like you could in the past. When you go to the grocery store, wear a mask. One of my friends said, man, I saw a guy spraying down all his fresh fruits and vegetables with Lysol as he exited the store. Don't do that. we've talked about this before, that even if you left your groceries on the counter, the cans and everything on the counter for a few hours, we can detect coronavirus a day after, or some things 3 days after. But it's not enough to infect you. After a few hours, there's probably not enough there to ever infect you. And so don't kill yourself trying to save yourself from the coronavirus. It's not needed to spray down your, if you want to wipe things down, if that makes you feel better, go for it. But make sure you're not killing yourself with chemicals.
You got the grocery cart, though, right? Yeah. You got the grocery cart, and you got doors.
Two carts apart, you know, that's what they're saying, two carts apart. And the other piece is limit your, you don't have to go to Safeway every day. You know, try and limit your, you know, your shopping trips so that, you know, you are doing that social distancing.
I think that, you know, we are really fortunate. I was just talking to a colleague of mine in Seattle yesterday, and they, like, literally can't go anywhere because of just the population density is so high there that, you know, trying to get out to a, like, they can't go to a, you know, anywhere because there's always just, there's so many people around. And so, we are really fortunate in a place like Kodiak to have, you know, I think my advice to someone in Seattle or in a really metropolitan area might be a little different than in Kodiak, because trying to get outside safely in a place like Seattle is going to be harder versus here, where we have countless trails that are out. Plenty of social distancing abounds, you know, in Kodiak, outside, and people can still get out and do those things. So
even on the bike trail, there's room to be 6 feet apart from people.
Right.
Take a walk.
Hey, well, thank you all for coming in and sharing your knowledge again with us. Best of luck in the coming week about dealing with this, and let's hope we stay at zero.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much.